Okay. All right. So if you could, just start with the story of your life. And when you moved to Lexington, did you live on the campus?
No,
or did
I did
you
not,
live
so
in
that's
town?
Very different. Yes.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Okay. All right. So if you could, tell me a few of your memories.
Well, I remember my father. He trained and taught at University of Illinois in Chicago, and so when I was around 5, we came to Lexington, and that's when he started his seminal work at the Addiction Research Center.
And he was trained. How was he trained?
He was a physician. Mm-hmm. And he got his doctor of medicine. He was a World War II veteran, and he lived through the Depression. And when he came back from World War II, he trained at the University of Illinois. He met my mother around that time too, and they married. I can't give you the exact date. It was two, three years before I was born. And she was a World War II veteran also, Phi Beta Kappa.
And what had she done during the war?
She was in communications. She was a lieutenant. Actually had a higher rank than my dad. But she was a WAVE, and he was in the Army. And he really credits his military experience. He was communications. He did radio repair, and he really believed that technology assisted him in his laboratory assessment of drug effects.
Mm-hmm.
So things came together in a really wonderful way for him professionally. So that what he had, his World War II experience was he was climbing up radio towers and get shot at, but repair radios, and then electronic experience he used in the laboratory.
Yes. It's so important when you go to labs now, you realize, the need for tinkering, people who
right.
do that kind of work.
Right. And then his physician background, he went, as I said, University of Illinois, and they wanted him to go into orthopedic surgery. And again, there's that hand thing where he loved the lab and the surgery with the animals. So I think it really, the fact that he was a physician, a radio repairman, and the military, all that came together to aid in the exquisite development of the experiments they did.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I know even I can remember like his last years going walking into see him at his lab. I work at the Med Center also, University of Kentucky, and he'd be over there doing an experiment, and you could see him. And that's, I think, one of the strongest messages I've got from him was you need to be in the lab, you need to run your experiments, you need to be hands-on,
mm-hmm.
Not delegate he was very much a hands-on researcher. And that's why he, I think, made so many brilliant discoveries is that he was watching the phenomena himself.
Yes, yes. Was he also, as I understand it, he hypothesized the existence of multiple opiate receptors from clinical observation.
I think it was serendipitous. I think one of his big things was serendipity,
mm-hmm.
that some of the findings that they made, now the science, you best to ask others. And then the other person you definitely have to interview is Jill Sloan, who was his lifetime colleague and is at the University of Kentucky now. She may be retired, but she is a wonderful... She started as a chemist and actually got her PhD under my dad.
Uh-huh.
And just an incredible person. But she was there to observe a lot of this. She worked with Dr. Wickler. And one of the things that she said that was so exciting there was how willing and excited people were to share the thoughts and ideas. Like my dad would hold these seminars and... it was a rarefied time.
Yes. They are... legendary.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
Can you tell me anything about them? I mean, did you
about
ever get any
seminars?
Sense of... Yeah.
No,
yeah.
I don't know anything beyond
how
that.
How he... Well, you must have... How would he interact with the other people who were there?
That I don't know. I mean, I wasn't a party to it,
Yeah.
I know he was rigorous and an extremely hard work ethic, which I think he expected... the same from his colleagues.
Mm-hmm.
One of the words he used to use was work brittle. He had little tolerance for being work brittle, that you work hard and you discover. And so in the lab, hard work. And I think he would say that beyond brilliance, which obviously he had, he would credit more diligence and perseverance and doggedness.
Mm-hmm. So how often would you go in? Would you go to the campus? I mean, did you go there much?
Just, some. I mean, I remember, what was impressive to me as a little kid was these huge keys, these ring of keys that would get into the inner sanctum of the prison. And I can remember him interacting with patients, and I guess it would be prisoner patients. And then I remember one summer I had to have a project, or one time I had to have a project, and actually he had me work with an animal study with Dr. Sloan. So he was very much, I would have to say, he truly loved science and was very encouraging of people to go into it and develop their scientific careers. And
including women, girls and women.
Absolutely women. I mean, that is, I have to say that he was... he clearly did not have any gender discrimination whatsoever. I mean, he was a big advocate of women's professional development. Hired, when he became the professor of pharmacology, hired Mary Vore, another person you might want to talk to in his other years, but later years at UK, very much was invested in the advancement of women in science.
Mm-hmm. And what happened to your mom? Once that move was made, what did she do once you were in Kentucky?
She's been a homemaker. Mm-hmm. I mean, she's a very, very, gifted, intelligent person, and raised the family, made sure that things... I mean, she basically is one of these truly giving people that devoted her life to my dad and her family. And, she wrapped herself around his needs. Mm-hmm. And
what's her name?
Catherine Reynolds Mark. Catherine.
Catherine?
Yeah, I go by Ann, but yeah, Catherine. Well, her full name is Catherine Jones, but she doesn't like the Jones, so I don't know if you want to mention that. Catherine Reynolds Martin.
Okay. All right. So they got there.
Mm-hmm.
And did he go there intending to stay?
I think I would assume so. I mean, I've never heard that question asked before. I mean, he went there to work with Harris Isbell and Abe Wickler, and I think he probably was intending to stay, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Many of the people who described the ARC were not necessarily intending to stay. That's why I asked.
Well, I think some cycled through, at least in part, as part of their military service, but,
yeah.
Because they were in the public health service. But, no, my dad, I think, went there fully... I mean, I don't know that he ever dreamed that he would discover what he did, but I think, and there, Don Jasinski, I hope, mm-hmm. Definitely you're talking
yes,
to him.
Yes, I've talked to him.
Yeah, there was just a wonderful...
I think he might have actually told me about you. I think it was Don.
Yeah,
he talked for 4 hours, so he said
he's a wonderful man.
Yes.
I think that's one thing that's maybe unique is I would say that there's just a really incredible love between the people that were there. I remember my dad retired, Dr. Jasinski described it as Camelot.
Yes.
And I actually have some letters that people wrote. I don't know if I could find those for you, but yeah, I think people found it a real special place.
Yes, yes. So when, was there a memorial service? Or
no, this is when my dad retired.
I see. So he retired in 70...
Yeah, it was right around the time I started... he came. It was interesting. We had a dialogue about it because I think he started there around the time either 70 was it 77 or 70 when he came to UK when he transferred to UK.
Well, I have that on my
computer. It was about the time.
I think it's around the time that they moved.
Right.
Like,
oh, it definitely was.
So it was.
And Dean Clawson came out to him, and said, here we've got this great person for the chair of pharmacology. We were like a secret out here or something, and. He really liked Dean Clawson, and I was starting medical school or residency right around the same time. I remember my dad asking me, is this going to work out okay? Of course it worked out fine. But, I remember that time.
Mm-hmm. And so can you tell me something about the interactions with patients that you observed?
Oh, very little. I mean, I think one of the things that he inspired in me was the curiosity of what to explore, why... people do what they do. I mean, I'm a child psychiatrist, and he's really fascinated by the addict.
Yes.
What makes him tick. And that was probably a part of his research that was less attended to, but he really did characterize, from his observations, the addict's personality. And he used the Addiction Research Center maturation scale to kind of try to capture how they are unique and how that propels them into drug use.
Mm-hmm. it's an interesting conundrum, really, for a historian, because sometimes the story of the ARC is told as, well, there was Lawrence Cobb and the psychopathic personality. Well, mm-hmm. sort of like what Conan did the other day.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so there's that and the psychopathic personality and all mm-hmm. that construction of mm-hmm. psychopathology. But then Wickler comes along, you know, and they really, Isabel Wickler Martin, really overturn that, and they show that it's not a psychopathology, but that, you know, this could happen to anyone.
No, I don't think this...
So how would you tell that story?
Okay, how I would see... So my dad's scale, the Addiction Research Center Maturation Scale, has a couple, five subscales. Actually, we've looked at it in kids. Okay, there's an impulsivity scale, a sociopathy scale, hypophoria. But there's some more. Egocentricity, I think there's one more. But what he would say is that people are wired, at least how I understand his writing is that people were wired differently. They had high need scales. They had a subscale.
Need.
They had high needs, and the world, it wasn't so much, I feel bad about what I've done. I'm like, the hypophoria wasn't, I feel so bad about what I've done. It's like, you know, the world's not treating me right. I deserve more than this. And so the opiates filled that gap between what they felt and what they thought the world served them, how the world treated them. So he definitely, even though he's not been cited with it, the self-medication hypothesis that these are people that have high needs, high wants, can't really think through problems, have that sociopathic deficit in problem solving and empathy and all that, and so they always feel kind of crummy, and so they end up taking drugs to make themselves feel better. So definitely, and then you can, he never did look at drug effects on that scale, so whether you truly moved into a better feeling state, but you know, the Addiction Research Center inventory obviously captures that good feeling that drugs give people.
Mm-hmm. And do you think that he, what would he have regarded as his key conceptual contributions?
Actually, he's got a Vita where he laid out his main discoveries, and I don't know, do you have a copy of that?
I don't think I have his, no.
Okay, well, I might be able to find it. I'm not sure where it would be, but if you could email me...
I will.
I could maybe make you a copy of it, because he actually had, like, maybe a page of what he considered his main discoveries. So that'd be better to hear it from.
That would be wonderful.
Yeah. And this is like... Just take that pop off of there.
Yeah, from outside. Okay.
Yeah, I don't know what that pop. Those are old cars, but I got thousands of them, so I need to use them up anyway.
Yes. Yeah. So I wanted to go back to where we started with the fascination with the addict's personality,
mm-hmm.
Because he was extraordinary at being able to go from sort of I don't know how you even describe subclinical phenomenon, but what's going on? I mean, he was clearly somebody who was looking at everything from sort of receptors on up.
Right.
And why do you think? I mean, what drove him to be able to conceive of the science in that way?
That incredible spectrum of understanding.
Yes.
That's a really good question. I mean, I really do think he was a Renaissance man. I think he, you know, thought of things from all perspectives. I mean, to know him, he really had this global sense of experience. I mean, to know my dad, you would know that he took great pride in how old his suit was. He coasted in a diesel rabbit to save energy. I mean, they had a tank built on the farm. I don't know if y'all want you put this thing just for diesel fuel. I mean, he really saw the universe in this. Everything we did affected something, and concern about pollution, expenditure of resources. I mean, he was an incredible man that way. Mm-hmm. That he understood from all sorts of levels.
Did he also have a sort of social bent to that? I mean, he was concerned about...
Oh, definitely. I mean, this man grew up in the Depression. He definitely saw the evolution of the cost of wanting and needing not just addicts, but greed, you know, mm-hmm. that there will be a cost to the division of the populace, you know, everybody that's got everything and those that have none, there will be an eventual cost of that.
And so
I bet one of his first donations was to the Negro. I think he may have actually gotten letters from this. I mean, he donated money to, you know, like the Negro College Fund. I don't know if I put that in because I don't know that for sure, but I mean, he definitely had a huge social conscience.
Well, I think that this is interesting because, you know, the folks who are at the ARC for a long time, you would describe them as similar?
They were truly unique in that they were motivated by the love of science and the improvement of the human condition, and that was across the board from what I remember, at least the people that I knew. And yeah, I thought it was definitely this remarkable group of people that were motivated by these, you know, high-level goals.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I knew Abe Wickler. I mean, he taught psychiatry in my department. It was a truly remarkable bunch.
And how would you describe their relationship between your dad and Wickler and also Isabel? Then?
I think they had felt true joy in their interaction, discussing ideas, science. I mean, I think it was a euphoria of its own kind. You know, it was a hedonistic joy. I mean, I can't imagine how remarkable it was, these brilliant men and women. I mean, I think it was remarkable.
Who do you remember besides the obvious suspects?
Well, Ann Eisenman, heard her name.
Mm-hmm.
She was single, and when my dad would go out to meet, she would take me and my brothers and my mom out to dinner, and I can remember her coming to our house, and my dad and mom and her sitting listening to classical music and having a cocktail, and I mean, that was a real connection. A Wickler, I don't want this on tape, but I was a bit of a tomboy, and I actually fell off I was going down a steep hill on the back of a trike and flipped over and hit my head, and I mean, I would have been horrified if it had been my kid. I mean, I was throwing up and getting drowsy, and I can remember going to the ARC and Abe Wickler doing a Babinski on me and getting a skull x-ray, and I mean, but see, that's them. I mean, that was like this real, who'd my dad call? Abe Wickler, you know, and so there I was, and I remember one of my brothers being out, and my dad sewing him up out there, so it was a unique condition. I mean, Jewel Sloan is a dear family friend, and I mean, if you need to talk to her, absolutely.
Yeah, I will.
I remember here at Sillsville a little bit. I remember coming into Lexington when we arrived and going to his house. He has two daughters, and I remember them, you know, having dinner with them, and his daughters were just lovely. His wife, very elegant, and I think they're Southern. You know, I think he went to Tulane, and very Southern, elegant demeanor, and I guess those would be them. And Abe Wick, I remember, and Ada. Mm-hmm. I guess those would be the main memories. Mm-hmm. And Dr. Jasinski, of course, and Dr. Gordetsky. And,
yes.
Peter Mansky. I don't know.
Mansky. I do. You know, he's in Albany, supposedly.
He is. This has to be off the record. I don't know. He was a rascal. He was like wore sandals and a beard and played the guitar. And I remember there was a time. Maybe I don't know how much of this you want. Well, I don't know if I should tell you or not because I don't think it ought to be in the record. Do you think? What should we do here?
Well, let's see. I'm going to try because I've heard other stories about Peter from other people.
Did you hear about when I think it was Nixon landed on the campus and they called my dad? They were ready to shoot him because it was either Nixon or Johnson landed used the hospital as their landing site.
No, I have not heard this story.
Well, then you got to get a confirmation from somebody else.
Okay. But my Nixon or Johnson?
I can't remember who it was. I think it was Nixon, but I'm not. I remember Johnson came to Lexington. I can't remember. But anyway, so they used the hospital as a landing port, and my dad gets this call. Who is this guy? He's going to be shot if you know, he was violating security. He was curious. He wanted to go see the person. That was Peter. He ended up being my residency director, which was kind of funny when I was in residency. He didn't stay too long. I think that's after, I don't remember if he went to Mass General before or after that, but he's a character.
Yes, yes. It's what I heard was, he's Jewish, right? I mean, that he had unplugged Christmas tree lights.
Oh, my.
Or, you know, it was something. So was Peter, I mean, was there a generational, how did they deal with the new generation, right? So they're sort of there in an established sort of way, and many of them were hired about the same time. But then later, there
well,
began Jasin- to be.
Well, Jasinski was a newer one,
I believe.
And Peter was, I don't know why he was there. I mean, I don't know how they dealt with him. I mean, I know that he was a bit of a challenge. I remember another graduate student, my dad worked in Virginia, somebody. I mean, I think he really worked hard with people and wanted them to succeed. But, I mean, he was a taskmaster, there's no doubt.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell me a little bit about that aspect of his personality? Because that, of course, does come out in the stories.
You know, this is a man who grew up in the Depression, who was a key player in making sure his family, you know, had food on the table. He was involved in World War II, could have easily been killed. And so then you come in, is he ambivalent about what he says or thinks? Does he wonder about it? No, he knows exactly the way things are, and he's brilliant. So I think it was his way or the highway, you know. And, I mean, who can challenge that? I mean, you can, looking back, you can say, well, you could have interpreted this, not science, but, you know, other aspects of life, but I mean, how could he have been any other way?
It's amazing to me the number of people who have, you know, their first brush, because a lot of this, you know, generation had a first brush with either a burglar or with your father, and they have these stories of their first, you know, moments. I mean, Conan's story.
Oh, wouldn't it
be
wonderful?
Yeah.
I had to laugh out loud. That is that bunch.
And so, who did he have any particular heir apparent? I mean, did he?
Well, I thought Jasinski probably was.
Yeah, yeah, more than anybody else.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, and do you think over the course of the time that you saw him working, did his techniques, his sort of experimental techniques, change over that time, or did he basically stay with what he knew?
I mean, did he take on some advanced new technology like fMRI or something like that? I don't remember any drastic, but that would be best to, I mean, he, you know, drug effects and measuring, I mean, I think it's pretty steady.
Mm-hmm. And mostly in the humans, or did he also do animals?
No, he's a big animal person.
So
I would say more research was done. I mean,
yes.
both, but his...
And what animal models? I mean, what
animals did he use? Well, he used a spinal dog, which, of course, got animal rights people upset. And then I know they did some kind of implants in mice. Do you have Laura McNicholas on your list?
Laura McNicholas?
Is she McNicholas? She's here, and you need to talk to her, because she was one of his students, and that she may be another heir apparent. I mean, she worked closely with my dad, and now is with O'Brien, and, I mean, I think she cites in every other work. I mean, she just,
yes,
they had a very
right,
close, so
right.
You need to talk to her.
Right, we're interviewing O'Brien next,
right.
And then I'll
but
see
Laura
if
McNicholas
I can find her.
Worked with O'Brien and my dad, so, and she is here. I've seen her a couple times.
Oh, that would be great.
Yeah.
I will look for her. So, The spinal dogs were, Wickler sort of started with them. Did that become an animal rights issue when he was there at the ARC?
No, but I mean, I can remember, and I don't know that it was, I just know there was some kind, right before my dad died, actually, they had a television interview with him, somebody interviewed him about it.
Do you have it?
Somewhere, probably.
Could you find that?
Yeah, put that in your email. I'll see what I can find.
Yeah, that would be great.
Because I know the PR guy at the university said, oh, I love your dad, and it must have been the tape up. And I don't know, you know, I don't know if we have that or not. The university may or may not. I mean, some of that stuff's been hard for me to look at, but...
I would imagine.
Yeah, we were really close.
Yeah,
Yes. So anyway, I don't know if I've got a box of stuff. I can look through it and see, you know, what I can find.
Okay. What... There's not anything still there, is there?
At the Addiction Research Center?
Yeah.
No, you mean as far as when it transferred to Baltimore?
I'll tell you, one of the reasons I'm doing these interviews is because there's no archive.
My mom's got stuff. I don't know what. I mean, she's got a flag from there.
Is she there?
No, she's in Lexington, but
yeah.
See, they moved out to a farm, and then that's where my dad died, and she lived there until just like the last couple months. So there is stuff out there. I don't know. We're in the phase of destroying it. I mean, just trying to clean out house. So I don't know. I mean, she asked me, do I want the flag? I don't want the flag, but I don't know. I can ask her.
Yes, that would be, it would, we are trying to get an archive going because...
Where would you put it? I mean, you have a place for it?
We have a place. It's at the University of Michigan.
Okay.
The Substance Abuse Research Center and the Bentley Library. The Bentley Library will house things. And so that's what we're trying to work on.
Okay.
And that's our most viable possibility because we don't want this stuff to go. Because there, you know, the National Archives, there's stuff on Lexington, but it's all the Bureau of Prison stuff.
Yeah.
And there's nothing on the ARC.
Really?
It's very little. It's all on the administration of the rest of the institution. And, you know, there's, when you go into NIDA, to the intramural program in Baltimore, there's Clifton Himmelsbach's book of data sitting there.
Mm-hmm.
It's this sort of level of things, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that should either go there, or it should go, you know, into... But if he has... Do you have his papers? I mean, are there papers? Are there...
You mean like the manuscripts?
Yeah. Does he have any... Did he have lab notebooks or...
Yeah, I don't know if I can... I mean, I don't know what's happened to all that. I know it was at the farm, but I don't know. I mean, some of it got mildewed and stuff, so I don't know what's... I can...
Are you the only child?
No, I've got two brothers. I know one of my brothers who is an adjacent farm. They went through some of that stuff.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, I don't know what's left. I don't know.
Yes. And he didn't have papers go to UK, you don't think?
Well, Dr. Sloan might have some things. So she's at UK still.
Yeah.
And I know there were, like, old slides and things like that. I don't know what happened. You know, like these glass slides of animal brains and things like that, you know, slices. So there may be some stuff.
Yes. That would
but you need to talk to Dr. Sloan about that.
Okay. I will do that. If you could see what your brothers made it through.
Right.
Because it may not look like anything to anybody else. It may, you know. I went to Kansas City to Chuck Gorodetsky's basement and went through. He had boxes from the ARC that had never been opened. He just boxed it all up.
Well, he may have.
He had some, you know, what I'm looking, I'm interested in protocols, in anything that shows how they designed.
Oh, I don't know.
You know,
I don't
their studies,
I don't
that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I don't know anything about that. I doubt I'd have that. But
then there's other, whatever. That would be great if
I could
take a look.
Yeah, I can look.
Okay. That would be wonderful. I guess we should... Well, why don't you look and see what you can find.
Uh-huh. Be sure to email me.
Yeah, I will.
Okay.
I will. Believe me,
I mean, I've got a busy schedule.
So maybe we should do that sort of next, is you know...
See what I can retrieve.
Yeah. And see what made it past your brothers and what they would be...
Yeah, it would have been... We only got rid of what was, you know... I mean, it was mildewed. It was in the basement. And that would be the only cut. So I can... I mean, I have some things that things he wrote to me and stuff, but... Yeah, I can definitely look. That would be a good...
And if you do have correspondence from people in the field...
Yeah.
Who... That would be sort of... I mean, there's personal stuff, but then there's also stuff that's...
Well, I mean, I have, like, his letter of recommendation to Jerry Jaffe for something or other, like promotion or something. I mean, it's a beautiful letter.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like something to keep, like, well, if you ever want to write a brilliant letter for somebody, use this as your model.
Yeah, so he really had high regard also for Jaffe.
Absolutely.
An heir apparent in a way.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. I should have mentioned him. He's a wonderful man. So anyway, I can't think of anything else.
All right, well, we will be in touch.
What an adventure you're on.
Oh, it is.
How did you decide to go this
well,
route?
Well, I got interested in Lexington. I wrote a book several years back about... women drug users, and there was all this stuff on the opening of the Lexington Women's Building. And so I wrote about that. And as I was writing about it, I began to think, well, this is really interesting mm-hmm. when you think about the kind of scientific research that they were doing and everything. And then I looked around a little bit in archives. And I couldn't find much of anything. Mm-hmm. And I just thought, it doesn't exist. You know, it's not going to mm-hmm. work. And it just never occurred to me, since I'm a historian, that I could just go out and start talking to people mm-hmm. and sort of gain oral history, and that they would have papers in their basements, and that there would be a way to kind of put together an evidence base for writing about the kinds of... Because, I mean, one of my basic points in the book that I'm writing now is that there's something about the institution, the material conditions of the laboratory, that shape the kinds of conceptual contributions that come out of it. And so the kind of work that they were doing at Lexington, which, as you know, can't really be replicated in a lot of ways, you know, because that world changed completely
right.
with the, you know, sort of coming of bioethics and the animal rights stuff and, you know, everything. I mean, you know, when you read Abe Wickler's descriptions of what he had to do to keep those spinal dogs alive, you know, it's like, wow.
I never even thought about that.
You know, mm. you know, it's very, very, you know, so I, as a historian, you know, so I'm very interested in that. Like, how do you write about the kind of science that they were doing and how they were going about it and the material conditions within which they were doing their science? And you write not the story that is about, oh, the whole world's better now and all are, you know, now we're all ethical, and they weren't, you know, because that's not the story.
That's not the story.
They were incredibly
right.
ethically aware.
Oh, that's
they
right.
were incredibly, you know, they did not other, they did not see those addicts, you know, as, you know, that wasn't who they were. And so how do you write about that? How do you... you know, get onto that. What's the evidence for that? How do you convey it to other people? Because I think it's an incredible story about, you know, not just about a sort of social interaction between scientists, the way that science happens. So that's what I got interested in, and I think it's a fascinating place.
You know, one of my dad's quotes, let's see if I can get it right, and Mary Vore would be a good person to put this on. You know, like, he was a medical educator in part of his career, and I forget how he said it. Mary could quote him exactly. I'm not so much worried about the students as I am their patients. Like, in other words, popularity was not ever an issue for my dad. Mm-hmm. As you've probably mm-hmm. heard, mm-hmm. he wasn't out for that. He was out for the end result, which was to lessen human suffering.
Yeah.
And that has to be one of the strongest themes of what you write, because
yeah.
he was not into being center stage. He abhorred that. He didn't want to be bossed around. I know he wanted to be, you know, that's one of the things he said to me, is the reason you want to be chair is so that you will be the boss. Not because he liked power, but he knew how things should be.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And center stage, and he admired people that were good at that. You know, I remember that, I forget who it was he said, had such a wonderful, clear way of delivering and speaking and comfortable with that, and he admired that, but that was not him.
Yeah.
He was very, you know, it was his family, work.
Yeah.
Family science, I should say. And, you know, I mean, his farm, he liked to work on the farm and things like that, but he was not into, one quote of his was, well, he's got a good hat, a big hat size. You know, that was not him at all.
Yes, yeah. So he's more of the sort of, it's interesting because he's got a very strong personality that comes out, everyone talks about, and yet he's not an egocentric personality in the...
Not in the sense of narcissistic, mm-hmm. but definitely he knew the way it should be.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes. Yeah. Well, it's, so I mean, I'm just, it's very interesting thinking about what happened in the, when Wickler and Isabel retire and he sort of assumes the reins.
Now, see, he took over for Isabel, right?
Yes, yeah.
Yeah, and I don't know that was a popular decision. I think there was other people, I think, was it Harris?
Harris Hill?
I don't know who the heir apparent to. Now that's a sub story that I don't know enough about.
So you think that it possibly? Well, how would that decision have been made? I mean, why would they have? I don't know how they made the decision. No. In the room?
No, he wasn't in the... Everybody's now out of the room. He wasn't one of the people in it.
Oh, he must have forgotten. I came out early.
I'll keep looking around.
Okay. I'll turn my cell phone back on, too. We just have a short time with Chuck O'Brien.
I'm not interfering with it, am I?
No, because we can't find him now. And he was supposed to come here. But it's hard for people, you know, because you're scheduling in between all these other things. It'll be okay. So you think that there might have been... That it wasn't apparent that he was going to become the director of research at that point.
I don't know how a decision was made, and I don't know who would be able to answer that. Probably no. Maybe Dr. Sloan might be able to.
Yeah, she might have heard something.
Right. I mean, look at what my dad did. He was not the... what is the choice you make, like, between being a... gets along well with others, being a key thing as opposed to innovation and science. And, you know, he wasn't a corporate person. Maybe that's the way to say it. He wasn't a corporate person.
Yes, yes. He sometimes had to go to D.C.
Oh, yeah, there was a lot of administrative. He was a fabulous administrator from what I understand. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, things got done. I look at what happened there.
Yeah. Do you think that, well, obviously, once it becomes his, everyone is, people are very attracted to go there because of him.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of the younger generation, who are now the older generation, talk about going there specifically, you know, because he's there.
Right. Are you asking me a question?
Oh, no,
I'm just thinking aloud,
you know, thinking about the kinds of things that people have said he did. He would, you know, the sorts of interactions that he would have with the younger researchers.
Yeah, I don't know about that, I don't think.
Yeah.
I know is, like, when he retired, there was something about a footprint. I was like, you know, kicking the rear kind of thing.
Yeah, so did what
you,
did
are,
happen?
Did Bruce Vopel, do you have him on your list?
I have heard people talk about him.
Well, he was one of his main heir apparents. I mean, I think there was a lot of investment in Bruce, and so he would be a good person to talk to, because I've heard him talk about my dad, and, you know, I mean, actually, when he retired, I think they did give him something with a footprint embedded in it, like, you know, here's a kick in the butt, get going, let's move on.
So why did he retire when he did? I mean...
It was moving. He didn't want to move.
Yeah, he didn't want to make the move.
Yeah. I don't even heard the story on that, and then the dean had come to him and said, hey, would you... We got this gem out here. Could you hit up the pharmacology department?
Yes. Yeah. And he continued to do work.
Oh, absolutely. To the
there.
Day he died, he was on, you know, spinal nociception, and I mean, he really was still at the brilliant end of discovery.
And had he? The other thing that I'm trying to get at is the ARC was a relatively closed group of people, and it was geographically isolated, and it was represented as, you know, this sort of brilliant group. Does he say anything about the fact that there's other knowledge production that begins to happen around addiction elsewhere? You know, he was always in.
I don't know. I don't remember any comments about that. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think his plate was full.
Yes. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Wow. So the retirement stuff. What happened for retirement? What was it like?
Oh, they just had a dinner for him, and, you know, people come. And that's when the letters were written. That's the one where I read Dr. Jasinski's letter when Dad died. I went flipped through it and read his. That was Camelot. And,
yeah. Yeah. And when did he die?
He died in I think it's 93. May 27th.
Yeah, it's obviously still fresh in a way for you.
Well, I don't know how you... I mean, I don't... Yeah, I miss him. And especially, it was really strange the first... I've had an odd transition. I started out as a child psychiatrist. Not odd. child psychiatry, you know, trained clinically, and I've kind of come into research around, you know, Dad obviously had an influence on me, but I only started coming to this meeting a couple of years ago, and it was really strange, like, you know, everybody's, it was not too long after my dad died, maybe a couple of years, and everybody had to say something to me, you know, like, oh, how wonderful my dad was, and how they, he helped them, and it was like, it was cathartic for them, it was hard for me, I mean, it was good, but it was upsetting, and I was, even on the last day when I was in the pool waiting for to go off my plane, somebody at the table next to me saying they were getting Billy Martin, you know, at University of Virginia, I believe, and Bill Martin, somebody was a little bit confused, and they said, oh, no, Bill Martin is the one that discovered the sigma receptor, and the whole way it changed, it revolutionized the way we look at, you know, opiate receptors, and that was like this casual conversation. I mean, it's just,
Yes. So he saw the revolutionary change in the field in a lot of ways, right? I mean, he saw the visualization of the receptors, and he saw...
He led it.
Yes. And that's, I mean, it's so interesting to me because there are people who remember that, and there are people who don't. Mm-hmm. And so the sort of story of the multiple discovery of the opiate receptor is often not preceded by the fact that that he led that.
Right, because the sigma receptors had less clinical significance, at least as far as we understand it right now. It wasn't, you know, like the mu receptor. And so I think that can be, you know, I think that might, if he'd discovered the mu receptor as opposed to the sigma, then there we might be a different story. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, he totally revolutionized the way of looking at it. So, yeah, I think, I don't know why. And then, and like, again, if you look at science, part of it is promotion. He wasn't into that at all.
Yes.
And so, he may have missed out on some things because of that. I mean, he just never did that. That wasn't his thing at all.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah, and the opiate receptor, the people who did visualize the opiate receptor were way into self-promotion and continued to, you know, so I think that may be part of that story.
But life's short, and you got to make your choices.
Yeah. I think it's a wonderful story because it's a, it's very clear to me that he, in a way, I don't know whether you think this or not, but he could not have necessarily done that anywhere else.
Because I think you're absolutely right.
And can you give me any more to go on that?
Well, I think he was felt so privileged to work with the scientists that he did and the interface of animal and human research. I mean, I just think it was I don't even know how you... What would be even comparable now? What lab has this many totally innovative, brilliant researchers in the same place? I mean, where can you think of? I mean, there may be one or two, but not three or four that have pretty much they could do what they wanted.
Yeah.
And they were all remarkably good people.
Mm-hmm.
And loved science.
Mm-hmm. That's wonderful.
Yeah.
We could end there. That's a
okay.
That's a beautiful quote.
Yeah.
And, I don't know that you could do better.
Yeah.
All right. So I gather you may have had a longer interest in the problem of drug abuse research than the buprenorphine story. So if you could, for me, start with your pathway into the field. How did it come to be a problem that interested you?
Back in some decade that I don't remember, I was doing contract packaging for running a small company that did contract packaging for hospital pharmacies, principally in Virginia, doing the Medical College of Virginia and the University of Virginia, at a time when unit dose packaging first came into being. And in the course of that business, there was a need at a methadone treatment program, which had initially been part of VCU or MCV, for take-home doses of methadone to be developed and we developed a 1 ounce individual bottle of vehicle called Methabuse, which was a vehicle for the dispensing of methadone. This was long before the computerized systems that we have today.
And what was your role in that?
Well, I was running that company, so I, in the process of that company, I began developing what we hoped would be an abuse-resistant vehicle for dispensing methadone so that patients could take the methadone home. It was actually a... we used psyllium husk to add after the when they dispensed the methadone into the vehicle, they then dispensed a measured amount of psyllium and shook the bottle, which turned it into a gel. And they were given that bottle and a wooden stick to pull it out of when they went home, and they mixed that with water, diluted it with water, so that they could take their methadone home, and kids couldn't get into the vehicle.
So prior to that time, had you had any exposure to methadone maintenance or opiate addiction?
No, but about that same time, for that program, we began to develop a toxicology laboratory. We opened a small toxicology laboratory to do urine analysis for drugs of abuse.
And is that where you came across Chuck Gorodetsky?
I don't remember the first time I came across Chuck Gorodetsky.
Okay. And would you have said that is in 1970s or late
60s? Yeah, earlier. It was probably late 60s.
You think it was late 60s?
Yeah, it was late 60s, I think.
Okay. And
It was late 60s, because after that we started also doing providing the same services to drug treatment programs in Atlanta, and that was when President Jimmy Carter was governor of Georgia. So whatever that time frame was, may have been late 60s, early 70s.
Okay.
Well, it must have been when the...
It would have been
Nixon
70s.
Went into office at 72.
Yeah.
Okay.
And what were you doing during that era?
And when... So it was late 60s. It was around 68 or 70, something like that. Because when... in the Nixon administration, when Jerry Jaffe went into... as drug czar... one of the people, among many of the people still around, who was there, was Peter Bourne. Mm-hmm. And Peter Bourne brought me in to do a lot of work in the field of toxicology, laboratory testing.
So you and are the Charles O'Keefe who was associated with Peter Bourne?
Yes.
Okay. Good. So he brought you in, you mean to D.C.?
Well, I was in D.C. at that time. Actually, I had sold the laboratory, toxicology laboratory, and merged it with Washington Reference Laboratory. Washington Reference Laboratory had the contract for military urine analysis during Vietnam. And I subsequently became executive vice president of the